Indicated the title of my split sermon, Two Mountains, Only One Choice. And it'll become a little bit more clear, the specific meaning of the title, as we get further in. But as most of us do, there'll be some groundwork to lay to get there. Now, most of us have gotten lost on the road at some point. And as with many things in life, how we cope with the challenges of that, as with other things, is at times more important than the original situation. I know I'm not very good at coping with that particular challenge. I remember one evening, Shelley and I got lost in Boston, eventually made back where we needed to, but it was stressful. Often we make it worse, and I've done that as well. I know that I've done that at several times. I know. Do we become obstinate? Stubborn? Won't use Google Maps now that that exists, or ask someone? That was the old comment, right? Won't ask for help at a gas station or a convenience store. Do we struggle in silence and make the situation more and more complicated and just raise tensions when it was really unnecessary in the first place? I've been thinking a lot about weakness and sin lately, and not necessarily the dramatic categories, the seven deadly sins that Mr. Norbert Link mentioned a few sermons back, which I found very interesting, fascinating, but the weakness in faith that may insinuate in our thoughts at times when we are most vulnerable. For me, Monday mornings have just always been, and I say a favorite, I mean just the opposite, but a favorite bugaboo for me. I somehow escalate every challenge on a Monday that I face at home, at work, obviously, with my physical condition, and a recent, just last week, but rare rainy Monday, and we badly need the rain, so shouldn't have complained by any means, only increased my own feelings of dread and maybe a little bit of hopelessness, which is silly in retrospect, but felt very real on Monday morning. Now, was the situation more dire in the 48 hours from when I left on a more relaxed Friday afternoon? I'd left the challenges of work behind, knowing that I was coming into the Sabbath and I could let it all go. And then I walk in Monday morning. And of course, the answer was no. It was in me. It was within me, within my brain, within my heart. And that weakness, if we want to call it that, can be within each of us at some point. We know that. I think we know that. I think we can all accept that. When God led the Israelites out of bondage towards the promised land, he asked one thing, really, simple thing, in return for his love and his generosity. And we all know it to be very simple, obedience. And this meant not only adherence to the commandments that God would have given to Moses, but very importantly, to trust him and all that he is. When God says that he will deliver us, we need to believe him, regardless how we're feeling at any moment. In our world, and this is not a prescient, shock revelation for all of us, but with the evil that is surrounding us, and I say evil, maybe it's small e, although can evil ever be the small e, but I mean it's pervasive in so many ways. We can falter in our faith and our reliance on God's promise. And again, I'm not talking about the traditional big things that you can easily identify, not the obvious ways, but when we credit other human beings with the power to hurt us and complicate our lives, as the ancient Israelites had done, peering into the land of Canaan at Kadesh Barnea, but afraid of what they saw, or believed their eyes had convinced them of, we can become so afraid that we forget God's insistence that he will provide. Had he not delivered his people in a miraculous way? Had that not happened? Had they not witnessed that and lived through that and provided for them on their journey? We know the stories. We absolutely know these stories. whether we're well-schooled in the Bible or still learning, we know the stories. He brought them through the sea. He provided fresh water. He provided bread. When the Israelites complained that they had better back with the Egyptians, God became visibly in his reactions with Moses and understandably angry. But through the constant interaction with Moses, God listened and his love for his people shone through. He provided them with nourishing manna. Consider God's reaction to the complaints. We're going to begin our study today in Numbers 11, and actually quite a bit in the book of Numbers. But Numbers 11 and in verses 1 and 3 to begin. Now, when the people complained, it displeased the Lord, for the Lord heard it, and his anger was aroused. Why wouldn't it be? So the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some in the outskirts of the camp. So God did have his anger, and he did manifest it in a very specific and dramatic way. You know, he loved his people, but he was not going to let them off the hook for their complaints, which again, equal to unreliance or mistrust of him. And that is sinful, whether we understand that or not. So let's continue. Again, we're going to be in Numbers for a little bit. Let's continue by considering Numbers 13. And we're going to read together verses 17 through 20. And this is a very interesting, the book of Numbers, it, for many of you who have read it and are very schooled in this, it's very interesting talking about the journey from Mount Sinai and all that occurred with Moses on the mountain with God and what the people were doing back down at the camp and how long they had spent at the camp, which was just about a year before they moved on with God's leadership. But as they were approaching what would be the promised land, Moses was directed to send out 12 spies to the land of Canaan and to take a look at what they faced. So again, Numbers 13, verses 17 through 20. Then Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan and said to them, "Go up this way into the south and go up to the mountains and see what the land is like, whether the people who dwell in it are strong or weak, few or many. Whether the, and this is critical, whether the land they dwell in is good or bad, whether the cities they inhabit are like camps or strongholds, whether the land is rich or poor, whether there are forests there or not. Be of good courage and bring some of the fruit of the land. Now the time was the season of the first ripe grapes." So that was the direction. That was what Moses was directed to do, to send these people out to spy out what was going to be their land and come back with a report. Now, when the spies returned to Kadesh in the wilderness at Paran, they reported that the land truly flowed with milk and honey, as had been promised. There were many fruits. The land was very rich, but all was not well. The spies noticed that the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amalekites, all had strong and fortified cities. And perhaps due to their own abundance, they were well-nourished and very strong, maybe stronger than many they could have imagined. And we don't need to turn here, but in Numbers 13 and in verse 31, the men who had gone to spy stated that they were not able to go against these people because of their strength. That was their conclusion. If this was a news report today, CNN or Fox News or maybe even social media, the report would have been very bad indeed. Perhaps something like reporting on the size and strength of the Russian military in Ukraine as they set out to attack. The men reported that they were like, the Israelites reported that they were like grasshoppers as compared to the descendants of Anak. Now, two of the spies, and we know these names quite well, Joshua and Caleb, they were there. They saw the same, let's call it threats. But In the business parlance, strengths, opportunities, threats, that sort of thing, the SWOT analysis, they saw that, but they took the positive approach. They responded properly in the faith in God. And we're going to turn to Numbers 14, and we're going to look at verses 6 through 9 that I think helps to make this point very clearly. And we're going to consider the faith and the strength of these two men, again, Joshua and Caleb. So reading in Numbers 14, verses 6 through 9, Joshua, the son of Nun, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, were among those who had spied out the land. They tore their clothes, and they spoke to all the congregation of the children of Israel, saying, "The land we passed through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord delights in us, he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, nor fear the people of the land, for they are our bread. Their protection has departed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them." Very clear message from two of the leaders. Now, it may seem very strange for us to ponder this, and we may think that we would trust in God every time. This is something I think about quite often. If we were there, we're baptized, we're believers, would we have that strength, that faith, to trust in God as he requires of us, not just in the big things, but in all things, the trust in him, to rely on him when we're having those struggles, those challenges that may in fact be coming directly from him. Would we have that faith? What about that simple rainy Monday that I mentioned just from a week ago? Would we feel defeated and lost? Is that not the same? Does unbelief that we may sense allow room for Satan to influence us in our weakness and drive us away from God? There are only two pathways. If you look at a continuum, a sliding scale of where we are, and we have God and we have Satan and evil. Where are we on that scale? Everything we do moves us along that scale every single day, perhaps every single moment, in our thoughts, in our deeds, in our interactions with one another, in our interactions with God. Do we rely on God? Do we start our day with God? There are only those two pathways. One drives us towards God, the other away from him and his son. Even a status quo position where we are perhaps a bit lazy and we don't make lots of progress, but we feel we are believers and we're dedicated. But that is perhaps what God would consider, and you know this word, lukewarm. And we're not going to turn here, but I think we know the scripture very, very well in Revelation 3 and in verse 16, what God has to say about neither hot nor cold in our passion and how we are lukewarm and what that would mean to him. Excuse me. Now, the Israelites were not lukewarm on their journey and their reaction to the report from the spies and also from Joshua and Caleb. They complained bitterly, and they anguished and compared their perceived plight, to the good old days in Egypt as slaves. They even decided to select a new leader to bring them back to Egypt. Now, how would they have been perceived in the old country? Welcomed lovingly? They were, in the eyes of the Egyptians, responsible for the death of Pharaoh and the army in the sea. I don't think things would have been good. Moses had to intercede with God. He had to plead the case with God, who had decided to give up on the disobedient and ungrateful Israelites and begin anew with Moses, but destroy the people for good reason. Let's face it, the complaints, the bitterness, the disobedience, the out-and-out disobedience and reliance on even creating other false gods during the time when Moses was on Mount Sinai. Now, we're spending so much time in Numbers because it sets the stage for the eventual arrival in the Promised Land during the journey, and the clear choice that God offered to his people and for all of us today. Now, again, continuing in Numbers 14, and I'd like us to read in verses 15 and 19. Numbers 14 and in verses 15 through 19. And this is Moses pleading with God. And you have to put yourself in the mind frame of listening to Moses and his interaction with God as he's feeling like the desperation of God, knowing God has had it. He's had it with the complaints. He's had it with the disobedience. So Moses breaking in at verse 15. Now, and this is with God. Now, if you kill these people as one man, then the nations which have heard of your fame will speak, saying, because the Lord was not able to bring this people to the land which he swore to give them to Abraham and the ancestors, therefore he killed them in the wilderness. And now I pray, let the power of my Lord be great, just as you have spoken, saying, the Lord is long-suffering and abundant in mercy, forgiving iniquity and transgression, but he by no means clears the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation. Pardon the iniquity of this people, I pray, according to the greatness of your mercy, just as you have forgiven this people from Egypt until even now. God relented. He listened to Moses. He certainly knew what still had to be done, but he spared the rebellious people, but declared that they would not enter the land which God had promised to their fathers. This was a 40-year sentence to life, if you will, for their failure to obey God and to follow God's direction as he was leading them on the journey. His cloud went in front of them. They were not alone. It's not like they were just, you know, lingering and trying to find their own way. They had the guidance. They had a great leader, and they had inspired by God. This 40-year sentence to life for their failure to obey God was dramatic. However, God said to Joshua, Caleb, and the children of the Israelites who had turned their backs on him, that the children would enter, but not the people who had rebelled. The lack of faith did not end at this point, sorry to say. Nope, the Israelites decided that they would attempt to enter the land regardless of God's decision. And they, of course, were rebuffed time and again by the Amalekites and the Canaanites who drove the Israelites back. Now, of course, when God decided it was time for them to go in, that was going to be a different story. Now, I face many managerial challenges in running my own company, but having considered the book of Numbers and this journey and how the people reacted, I know that Moses' challenge was unlike anything that any leader had ever faced by any stretch of the imagination, that God still allowed his people into the land after paying the price for their disobedience was a true act of mercy. When they were trying to enter the land of Canaan, the Canaanites hired Balaam, who was a Gentile leader, to basically spew curses at the Israelites. But God's mercy intervened. And because of that intervention, he could do no more than offer blessings on the Israelites, just the opposite of what the Canaanites had expected. Now we're going to move ahead a bit, and we are going to get into the point of where the mountains come into play. Very important. And God uses mountains, as we know, to make points. He certainly used it with Mount Sinai and with Moses in a dramatic way. But let's move ahead in the story, in this era, and open in Deuteronomy. We're going to begin in Deuteronomy 27, and we are going to begin in verse 4. Therefore it shall be, when you have crossed over the Jordan, that on Mount Ebal you shall set up these stones, which I command you today, and you shall whitewash them with lime. And continuing in verse 5, and there you shall build an altar to the Lord your God, an altar of stones. You shall not use an iron tool on them so they would be as pristine as possible. And just recently, in the last few years, archaeologists found a little amulet, I think it was made out of lead, that had the name of God inscribed on it. It was attributed to ancient Hebrew in this area where, in all likelihood, on Mount Ebal, the altar of Joshua was. But we're going to continue now in verse 9. Again, we're still in Deuteronomy 27. In verse 9, then Moses and the priests, the Levites, spoke to all Israel, saying, take heed and listen, O Israel. This day you have become the people of the Lord your God. Therefore you shall obey the voice of the Lord your God and observe his commandments and his statutes, which I command you today. The Israelites had traveled across the Jordan and into the valley between Mounts Ebal and Gerizim in Samaria. And it's just above what is today known as Nablus. And that's, I think, in the territories on the West Bank. Moses had some of the leaders of the people stand on Mount Gerizim. And I ask you to go in your leisure and look at Deuteronomy 27. And you can see the names of the individuals who were designated to be on Ebal and on Gerizim. And the representatives sent to Gerizim were to bless the people, and others who would stand on Mount Ebal were designated and directed to pronounce the various sins that would curse the people who disobeyed God. So God was clearly setting up two choices with these two mountains. They had come into the land, and now they were very clearly being told by God what they needed to do. If they hadn't already heard this time and again on the journey, they're in the land and now they understand, obey God in all things, trust in God in all ways, or you will be committing these infractions, these sins, and your future is obviously left in doubt. Interestingly, God chose the carved image as the first transgression that he would bring, that would bring a curse to the people. And of course, that had happened during that period of time when Moses was on Mount Sinai and the people were busying themselves down below in camp. And I would recommend that we read the full text of the scriptures of cursing and blessing, as you can find them in Deuteronomy 27 and verses 15 through 26. We don't have the time to cover it today, but it is fascinating. The entire series of books of Deuteronomy and Numbers really tells such a story of the journey of the Israelites and the faith and dedication of God to his people despite their disobedience. On Mount Gerizim, again, the blessing of the people who diligently obey was what the focus was. The Israelites in the valley below would be very clear in what they heard, clarity as to the transgressions from Ebal, and clarity of the blessings that would accompany their obedience to God's commandments. They had not done a very good job to this point, but God also delivered his people through Joshua and had pleased God, who had pleased God with his faith in a battle in the kingdom of Ai, a former Canaanite city, now thought to be the modern archaeological site of Et Tel, which is fascinating. You can look that up as well. Joshua would then build the altar that he was commanded to build and had on Mount Ebal for the peace offerings that God had commanded of the people. Shifting gears a little bit, we're gonna move forward to Joshua. Now, we've mentioned Joshua. Now we're going to read in Joshua 8. And in verses 32 and 35. And there, in the presence of the children of Israel, he wrote on the stones a copy of the law of Moses, which he had written. Then all Israel, with the elders and officers and judges, stood on either side of the ark before the priests and the Levites who bore the ark of the covenant of the Lord. The stranger, as well as he who was born among them, half were in front of Mount Gerizim, and half in front of Mount Ebal, as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded before that they should bless the people of Israel. And afterward, he read all the words of the law, the blessings and the cursings according to that is written in the book of the law. There was not a word of all that Moses had commanded which Joshua did not read before all the assembly of Israel, with the women, the little ones, and the strangers who were living among them. God had indeed delivered his people, despite themselves, their treachery, and their disobedience. And if during this story you felt maybe a little bit of, maybe loathing is a strong word for the whining and the complaining, it was very dramatic. If you've not read, you need to read it and get a sense of, you know, sometimes I think we amplify what we believe to be the belief and following and obedience to God, who were delivered by the Israelites who were delivered. But the reality was they were very human on this trip. So if you felt that bit of oddness about the complaining, imagine how God might appear to have felt. Perhaps they would feel a kinship with us, these Israelites, because let's face it, at times we're no better when we cast aside the future that God offers us. Again, think of that continuum. We're either moving closer to God or we're moving away from God. And maybe that's something we need emblazoned in front of our eyes somehow, as a heads-up display every day to understand where we're going. God offers us love, respect, obedience. God offers us love in return for our respect and obedience to him. On Mount Sinai, God provided the commandments to Moses. And on the two mountains of Samaria, God illustrated the sins and made clear that those who obey will reap the benefits of eternal life. Let's read a final scripture together. And again, we're going to stay in Deuteronomy here. Deuteronomy 28, and in verses 1 and 2. Now it shall come to pass, if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all his commandments, which I command you today, that the Lord your God will set you high above all nations of the earth. Continuing in verse 2, and all of these blessings shall come upon you and overtake you because you obey the voice of the Lord your God. So that's an important word, overtake you. Not only will we be blessed for our obedience, but the blessings will overtake us. Two mountains, clearly one choice for our future. And it offers a simplicity that is really amazing that we can hone on to and rely on to get where we need to be.